Okay, good afternoon and welcome to the 2013-2014 Legal Issues Webinar Series. This is the first session for this fiscal year. This session is sponsored by the Southwest and Great Lakes ADA Center on behalf of the ADA National Network. My name is Claudia Diaz and I am with the Great Lakes ADA Center. Before we get started, I want to go over some of the webinar features and make sure you're familiar with what this platform offers to you. If you are listening through your computer, as I mentioned before, you can adjust the sound by clicking the speaker icon found in the box labeled audio and video. It has a slider bar, which you can adjust left and right to increase the volume or decrease it as you prefer. Also, participants can access the session through the telephone. If you want to listen via the telephone, the number is on the screen right now. You can call in 712-432-3066. Passcode is 148937. Please note this is not a toll-free number. It is a local call. This webinar platform can be downloaded via the Apple iTunes Store, mobile apps stores, the Google Play, Amazon, Kindle. All of those have a mobile app version that you can download for free and access today's session. Also, as a note, if you choose to participate via the mobile platform, captioning is not available on that platform. If you want to access the captioning, you will need to participate via a desktop computer, and you can turn on the captioning by clicking the CC icon found in the audio and video box. Once you have that box open, it will pop up and give you the options to adjust the font size, increase the window, and move it around the interface as you prefer. You can submit questions a couple of ways. If you're on the platform, we have a chat box, which you can send a message to the moderator and the presenter. We will see those, and we will group those during the question and answer portion, and we'll provide those to the presenter. They will be private, so participants cannot see each other's questions. If you are on the telephone and you want to send a question, you can do so by sending it via email. I will monitor those and pass them to the presenters. That email address is webinars@ada-audio.org. If you're using a screen reader, you can access the chat area by using the keyboard control M, and that will put the focus for the mouse in the chat area for you. The whiteboard, which provides the PowerPoint presentation, can be customized as needed. Above the presentation, there is a drop-down that says Fit Page. Click on that drop-down, and it will give you percentages options that you can choose to make the presentation slides bigger or smaller as needed. Also, any of the boxes on the left-hand side labeled chat, participants, audio, and video can be detached. You would just click on the icon on the right side that looks like a piece of paper with lines. It will give you a drop-down of options. One of them says detach panel. When you do so, it'll move the box and you can adjust the interface as you prefer. Lastly, if you're still having technical problems with the platform or telephone, you can contact our office by calling 877-232-1990 or via email to webinars@ada-audio.org. At this time, I'd like to present Marissa DeMaia. She is from the Southwest ADA Center. She will be moderating today's session. Marissa?
Thanks, Claudia. Hi, everyone. This is Marissa DeMaia, and I will be serving as moderator for this session. Today's program is brought to you as a collaborative effort between the Great Lakes and Southwest ADA Centers, members of the ADA National Network. Again, this session is offered as part of an ongoing ADA legal webinar series. And I think Claudia mentioned before, I'll mention it again, today's session is being recorded and the recording will be available for review within about 24 hours at the conclusion of today's session. A copy of the PowerPoint presentation for today's session was available for download prior to the start of the session. If you were not able to access them, the PowerPoint ahead of time, you will be able to access the material in the archive section of the website at www.adaaudio.org/archives/ADA legal /. within about 24 hours following the conclusion of today's session. So our presenter will provide us with valuable information today, and at the conclusion of the presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask questions. Please follow the instructions provided for submitting your questions to our presenter. You will not be able to view the questions as you submit them, but they will be viewable to me as your moderator and our presenter. So we will address them at the end of the session, and feel free to submit them as they come to your mind during the during the presentation. I'm going to begin today's session by turning it over in just a second to Aaron McCullough. For any of you who are not familiar with Aaron or his work, he is a licensed attorney and ADA consultant. He's also a former social worker, and he spent a great deal of his time working and pursuing the interests of people with disabilities and promoting compliance. So he's very gifted, and he's very passionate. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Aaron.
Yes, hey. Again, thank you for that fantastic introduction. That's actually way too kind. I do want to thank the network of ADA centers, and specifically the Great Lakes ADA Center and the Southwest ADA Center, my former employers, for inviting me back to do another one of these legal webinars. Again, I think these are great opportunities for people to be able to reach out and hopefully over an extended lunch period for most of us get a little bit of information. I myself participate in these presentations as a presenter, but as often and much more often as an audience participant. In fact, you will hear me reference a number of archived ADA legal webinars during this session, and I encourage you to consider those a great resource, as I did, in fact, in preparation for this. That being said, I also I want to just make it clear that we've also made available some links that I used in preparation that I think provide some guidance on the kind of broad content that we're working with here. But before I do that, I really want to thank the really excellent folks at the Texas Governor's Committee on People with Disabilities who suggested this topic to the Southwest ADA Center, who then came to me and asked if I would be interested in it. And of course, I jumped at the chance because I like the more, for lack of a better word, nerdy and outlier explorations of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which I think this is going to evolve or devolve into, depending on your perspective. Again, I provided a list of links for materials, including the fact sheet on the EEOC's final regulations implementing the ADA Amendments Act. Another good publication from the NCD, a preliminary analysis of court decisions that followed the ADAAA, and I'll reiterate this later, but the EEOC's questions and answers on the application of Title VII and the ADA to applicants or employees who experience domestic violence or dating violence or sexual assault and stalking. In addition, a link to a prior webcast that I was involved in on pregnancy discrimination, disability, and the Americans with Disabilities Act. I encourage you to look at that one particularly, not because of my participation, but mainly because of the attorney and law professor, Jeanette Cox, who I think really in the last couple of years has aided in bringing this argument of the application of the ADA to certain circumstances for women who are pregnant or who were recently pregnant. In addition, the participation from the EEOC's own Marty Ebel, who's the deputy director of the Houston EEOC office and who is a peerless and brilliant and attorney and I think a testament to how, you know, dedicated certain parts of our federal government are, no matter how much you may doubt them after the recent shutdown. I have no doubt that Marty and his peers across the EEOC are again, our hardworking, interested, and passionate professionals. Okay, so moving forward, I'm gonna try to march through this material in a workmanlike manner. I do want you to ask questions. We're going to probably wait until the end unless something very, very relevant comes up. I'm going to leave that to the good judgment of Marissa. But I do want you to pose those questions without fear, because this presentation is actually going to be built on what you, you know, on the direction that you want to go, and I think will be refined certainly by your interests and your real world experiences. So again, please do ask questions. Okay, into the content. I think the simple goals are to define the disability under the ADA and then how that changed under the ADA Amendments Act. I'm going to discuss briefly some of the limits of the definitions, and we're going to spend the bulk of the time discussing ADA protections to what some, and I say some, would consider more outlier impairments or situations. Again, depending on who you are on the spectrum, a person with a disability or advocates for people with disabilities, employers or the defense bar, you may feel differently about this discussion, but I do think that you have a role in this discussion. So we, again, are entertaining questions from both sides if there are, you know, those, such polarized positions. But I think, again, I think that there's some valuable input to be had from people who do seek a more expansive view of the protections of the ADA and those who would seek to more clearly define it. So again, please ask away. Just don't be mean. Just a little bit of background. The ADA was signed into law, as I think probably all of you know, July 26, 1990, by then President George H.W. Bush. And a definition of disability was created within the law and certainly refined within the regulations. I think it's just as important to define what the ADA is not, because all too often, particularly among people with disabilities and advocates, there's a misunderstanding about, you know, the particular application of the ADA in context of other definitions of disability or impairment. So, for example, workers' compensation systems generally vary from the ADA in as much as that they are systems to compensate for work-related injuries or death. They're paid for by the employer compensation insurance contributions. Workers' compensation laws only apply to work-related injuries or illness, but again, under most schemes, the injury or illness doesn't have to occur at the workplace so long as it's job-related. You know, for example, an employee who gets injured while they're traveling on business or while doing a work-related errand or attending some business-related function would potentially be covered under the Workers' Compensation Act. And again, these covered injuries and illnesses can range from sudden accidents, such as, you know, falling off, the really obvious things, falling off a roof or scaffolding, to, you know, injuries that may happen over time, such as, you know, repetitive stress injuries or illnesses that, you know, result from exposure to, you know, workplace pollutants or chemicals, or in the very rare case, radiation. We get this question quite a bit, or I certainly did when I worked for the ADA centers. I'm covered by the Social Security Administration. I have SSDI. Am I a person with a disability under the ADA? And the definitions are different. Just to be clear, the definition of disability under Social Security is different, you know, from any other programs, and certainly different than the ADA. The Social Security pays only for a total disability. There's no benefits that are payable for someone who's determined to be partially disabled or for disabilities that are short-term. Disability under the Social Security Act is based on an inability to work, and the Social Security Administration considers you disabled under Social Security rules if you cannot do the work that you did before, or that they decide that you can't adjust due to your impairment or your conditions, you can't adjust to other work, that your disability has lasted or is certainly expected to last for at least a year or kill you. In addition, medical service-based disabilities are determined by a fairly complex scheme called the Veteran Affairs Schedule for Rating Disabilities, or the VASRD. And that's a system for categorizing and determining a level of disability and establishing a rating. Each rating that is developed under this schedule tries to reflect how much a service member's ability to work is affected by the condition, and the consideration is sort of aimed at can that person work to support themselves or, and their family? Is she able to perform tasks of daily life, such as dressing, cooking, or shopping? The ratings, you know, have been designed and certainly more recently refined to try to represent as far as can be, quote, practically determined, the average impairment and earning capacity that results from diseases and injuries that are related to military service. And that determination needs to look at that impact in civilian life, not necessarily how it would impact somebody in their military service. So under that scheme, military members are given, you know, medical evaluations, and they're assigned a certain disability ratings in a 10 percentage point interval. So you may have heard somebody say, I've got a, you know, 30% disability in this and a 40% disability in that, when they're talking about medical service-related disabilities. And the system, the VSARD, sorts conditions into numerous categories, you know, such as those things that are musculoskeletal, you know, bone injuries or arthritis or joint damage, muscle injuries, limitations in sensory organs, neurological damage. Now understand that the VASRD was created to regulate the amount of compensation for a disability, and it's focused on that. It's often criticized, you know, for several things, but particularly for the ambiguity that's inherent in a system that leaves a great deal of room for interpretation, and there's a lot of claims for inconsistencies, and it's inarguably an imperfect system. It was created by lawmakers, but it intersects with the judgment of medical professionals, and it results in sometimes I think clearly real-world negatives for servicemen and servicewomen. In addition, the ADA definition of disability is not the same as any definition determined under a private short-term or long-term disability insurance coverage. Essentially, the definition of what, you know, the eligibility for whatever, you know, poultry-inspired or poultry-mascotted coverage is basically based on the contract. So it's going to be defined in the particular contract, the level and severity and duration of an impairment and what would compensation be. So moving forward, again, all these things may very well represent a certain level of impairment or an evaluation of a disability, but they do not equate and they are not exchangeable with the definition of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act that would trigger the protections of the ADA for someone claiming that level of impairment. Most of you no doubt know that the ADA's definition of disability always has been discussed as having three prongs, which only means that the eligibility for protections of the ADA are established in three ways or for three different types of situations, which I'll cover very briefly. Again, the language of the ADA definition of disability is the term disability means with respect to an individual that either a physical or mental impairment substantially limits one or more major life activity of that person, or they have a record of such an impairment, or they're being regarded as having such impairment. Again, I suspect that most of you are very familiar with the language of this this part of the definition. The first part of the definition makes it clear that the ADA applies to persons who have impairments, and certainly requires that certainly under the definition required that that this impairment must substantially limit a major life activities, and these were understood to be, back after the passage of the ADA initially, as seeing and hearing and speaking and walking, breathing, performing manual tasks, etc. And of course, judicially interpreted, flowing from that to expand into some other aspects of major life activities, including the ability to reproduce. And we'll talk a little bit about the case. That case. The second part of the definition protects individuals who have a record of disabilities who may not currently be disabled or at least substantially limited in a major life activity, but have a record of that. So, for example, someone who has a history of debilitating cancer, but they recovered from it and were subsequently discriminated against, or for somebody who has a situationally acute but successfully treated depression. The third prong, or the third part of the definition, protects individuals who are regarded as having an impairment or a disability that is substantially limiting, even though they may not have such an impairment. So, for example, if someone were discriminated against on the basis of a severe facial disfigurement secondary to an injury or some genetic condition, and were being denied employment because of the employer's perception that this person was disabled, then they would potentially be protected under the third prong of the Americans with Disabilities Act definition. And I think that's enough to belabor the point. And of course, this is I've discussed in great more detail in any number of other legal webinars, which again I encourage you to visit in the archives. So moving forward, after the passage of the ADA, the way that the law works is you pass some laws. Typically, there are regulatory agencies that are required to what they say we call promulgate regulations, and basically give you a set of tools to implement and enforce a particular piece of legislation. In this case, there's a host of relevant agencies that are charged with promulgating regulations and investigating and enforcing the ADA. But the biggies, of course, are the EEOC, the Department of Justice, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Education. And moving forward at the passage of the ADA, it became subject to a great deal of litigation and garnered a great deal of attention from the U.S. Supreme Court, I think in the scope of its of the civil cases that it heard during the relevant period. So, during the relevant period, so after the passage of the ADA, the Supreme Court in total, through the time of the last decision, heard approximately 435 total cases and decided and reported on those. And during that period, 21 of those cases dealt directly with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And at least two others had significantly impacted the ADA. So 21, depending on who's counting, 21 or 23 cases out of a total of 435 cases that the Supreme Court took up to review and decide on. It's a pretty significant cut. If you parse out all the other non-ADA cases, tear out all the criminal appeal issues, it still represents a significant percentage. So there was a great deal of interest in, you know, attacking or limiting or clarifying, depending on your position, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and a great deal of interest in the, you know, the Supreme Courts, both under Rehnquist and Edwards, in hearing cases in rendering decisions. 5 of those 21 or 23 cases dealt with the definition of disability under the ADA. The first being Bragdon v. Abbott, a case where the question before the court was whether an asymptomatic person with HIV had a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the court ruled that they did, after an analysis of whether or not reproduction was a major life activity under the ADA. Moving forward, the Supreme Court heard a line of cases, which you may be familiar with, the Sutton line of cases, Sutton versus United Airlines, Murphy versus United Parcel Services, and Albertsons versus Kirkenberg. In the Sutton case dealt with whether corrective or mitigating measures, in this case, commercial pilots who used eyeglasses to correct their vision, whether or not they were someone with a disability. And the court determined in what some consider an interesting analysis that these two people were disabled until such time as they put on their eyeglasses, which corrected their vision, so then they weren't considered disabled under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and could thus be was thus a defense to discriminate against them. Similarly, Murphy versus United Parcel Service looked at the situation and whether you look at someone in a medicated or non-medicated state. Albertsons dealt with a situation where an employer who was required as a job qualification to have binocular vision, whether or not due to a federal safety regulation would justify enforcing the regulation because the person only had monocular vision or vision through one eye. In addition, moving forward, the court very significantly in Toyota Motors versus Williams, Toyota v. Williams, decided to look at the definition of disability and determine whether someone was substantially limited or not in performing manual tasks, deciding that to analyze it in such a way that the major life activity would focus on whether or not Williams, in this case, was unable to perform a range of tasks that were central to most people in carrying out the activities of daily life, and not whether she was unable to perform her specific job tasks. Therefore, the court determined that, whether an impairment rises to the level of a disability under the ADA isn't limited to the activities in the workplace, but rather to manual tasks in general. So the Supreme Court applied the standards and reversed a court of appeals, and this decision became the part of the driving force for the passage of the ADA Amendments Act. But we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So it's, with the exception of Bragdon v. Abbott decision, all these other Supreme Court cases that address the definition of covered individual with a disability, restricted this broad scope of coverage under the ADA. It interpreted the ADA more strictly, and created a what some considered a too demanding standard to qualify as a person with a disability or to qualify for protections under the ADA. And in the view of pretty much anyone, these decisions diminished the protections of the ADA and under certain circumstances created kind of a perverse catch-22 where, yes, you're a person with a disability, but if you do something about it, then you're not a person with a disability if, in fact, it's effective. So moving forward, this line of cases inspired in part the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act that was signed into law September 25th of 2008. Let's see. Excuse me. So the ADA Amendments Act retains without amendment the existing definition of the term disability, but there was a minor reordering of the clauses due to an overall editing of the law. But it was the definition of disability under the ADA, I mean, I need to be clear about this, the definition of the disability under the ADA Amendments Act is a word-for-word, is a word-for-word acceptance of that legacy definition. So the old definition of the ADA disability is intact in the new legislation. But the big changes to the ADA Amendments Act are that it clarifies certain keywords and phrases and does a little bit more, which we'll talk about again in brief. I'm not going to spend too much time on this aspect of the specific changes wrought by the passage of the ADA Amendments Act and the subsequent regulations, because that has been the subject, as I've mentioned, of several of these legal webinars, including a very recent and good the litigation landscape 5 years after the passage of the ADA Amendments Act, which was presented, it wasn't last month, it was in September, by Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg, both from Equip for Equality. I encourage, again, those interested in the exploration more specifically of those changes and how that's played out in the courts over time to visit those archives and check that out. But to cover a kind of a quickie summary of the changes brought under the ADA Amendments Act, first, the Amendments Act detailed that the definition of disability shall be construed in favor of a broad coverage of individuals under the Act. So, Congress wanted to clarify, to specifically reject those standards that were laid out by the Supreme Court in a variety of these cases. And very specifically mentions the Supreme Court decision in Toyota v. Williams, in which case Congress, in writing the this law, and stated that they felt that the decision was wrong and that the EEOC's regulatory definition of substantially limits was overly strict. Second, the changes in the text of the law indicate that Congress intended to prohibit the consideration of mitigating measures, such as medication or assistive technology, certain accommodations, in determining whether an impairment substantially limited major life activities. So the text specifically rejects a Supreme Court decision, in that time Sutton v. United Airlines, and its companion cases, where the court had, as we mentioned, held that the mitigating measures must be considered in determining whether an impairment constitutes a disability under the law. The ADA Amendments Act also provides that impairments that are episodic or in remission are to be assessed in their active state. And again, we're going to talk about that a little bit more specifically in just a few minutes. A third major change was that the law provided additional guidance on major life activities. The ADA Amendments Act details and I must be very clear here, a non-exhaustive list of major life activities that include caring for oneself, performing manual tasks, seeing, hearing, eating, sleeping, walking, standing, lifting, bending, speaking, breathing, learning, reading, concentrating, thinking, communicating, and working. Again, Congress wanted to be abundantly clear that this was a non-exhaustive list, but also a very long and specific list. The ADA Amendments Act also lists major bodily functions specifically included, again, in a non-exhaustive list, but functions of the immune system, normal cell growth, any digestive, bowel, or bladder functions, neurological functions, other brain functions, respiratory, circulatory, endocrine, and reproductive functions. Again, in an effort to deal with a great deal of the ambiguity that was wedged into the ADA via litigation. Fourth major change that the ADA Amendments Act created was that it removes the requirement from the regarded as prong that there be a showing of substantial impairment of major life activity. The law also explicitly states that people who fall solely under the regarded as prong or the third prong of the definition, they are protected from discrimination, but any covered entities are not required to provide accommodations or to modify their policies or procedures for the persons who fall solely under that prong. In addition, a real quick summary of the changes that were brought under the ADA Amendments Act final regulations that the EEOC published and that became effective in 2011. The EEOC's regs indicate that certain impairments will be disabilities in virtually all cases, and I need to make that clear, in virtually all cases. While acknowledging that an individualized assessment is required, the regulations identify a set of conditions that will almost always be a disability, and these include deafness, blindness, intellectual disability, partial or completely missing limbs, mobility impairments that require the use of a wheelchair, autism, cancer, cerebral palsy, diabetes, epilepsy, HIV infection, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, PTSD, OCD, and schizophrenia. In addition, the EEOC's final regs expand the definition of major life activity to include caring for oneself, performing manual tasks, seeing, hearing, eating, sleeping, walking, standing, breathing, learning, reading, concentrating, thinking, communicating, and working. It also defined major life activity to specifically include operations of major bodily functions such as immune system and normal cell growth, again that list of digestive, bowel, bladder, neurological, brain, and reproduction for functions, etc. In addition, they add to that list sitting, reaching, bending, lifting, and interacting with others. They also add special sense organs and skin, cardiovascular, hemic, lymphatic, and musculoskeletal to the list of major bodily functions. And they again expressly reject the Supreme Court's holding in Toyota v. Williams that the regulations provide that a major life activity need not be of central importance to daily life. In addition, the EEOC regs indicate that substantially limits should be construed broadly. The regulations provide substantially limits should be construed broadly in favor of expansive coverage to the maximum extent permitted by the terms of the ADA. That's a quote. The regulations make it clear that, substantially limits is not intended to be a demanding standard. As had been so often interpreted by the courts. An employee must be substantially limited, compared to the general population, but an impairment doesn't have to prevent or completely restrict a person's ability to perform a major life activity. Also, in most cases, according to the regs, an individual's performance of a major life activity compared to the general population will and should be measured without scientific, medical, or statistical analysis. In addition, disabilities that including temporary and episodic conditions and conditions and remissions may be protected, and disabilities include episodic conditions or conditions that are in remissions, provided that the impairment would substantially limit a major life activity when it's in its active state. Okay. And again, this is just a real thumbnail sketch. If you feel I didn't cover it in depth, and I'll admit that I didn't, I encourage you to visit again some of those archived earlier presentations that deal specifically and at length with both the law and the legislation and the regulation of the ADA Amendments Act. Okay, getting to some of these more specific what some folks may consider outlier applications. With regards to episodic or cyclical impairments or impairments that may be in remission, prior to the ADA Amendments Act, a condition that was in remission or where someone's symptoms or symptomatic impact came and went was cyclical, they would not likely be covered under the ADA, and it would say it would be and certainly was argued in litigation. What this meant was that a person, with a mental illness or MS, might not be entitled to accommodations in the workplace when his or her condition was active, because they did not meet the definition of disability due to the cyclical nature, or an analysis that would consider that person not to be disabled. The ADA Amendments Act, to a certain extent, resolves this problem. Now, the fact that the period, well, specifically addresses this issue. Now that now the fact that the periods during an impairment that substantially limits somebody may be episodic is no longer relevant to determining whether the impairment substantially limits them in a major life activity. So essentially, if it would be a suitably disabled level of impairment when active, then it's considered to be limiting of a major life activity. So the job accommodation at work has always, I think, provided some pretty good examples of the application of this, as well as some good guidance on how to accommodate people with very specific disabilities, including disabilities that are more episodic or cyclical in nature. Again, Jan provides the example of a person who has a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, who experiences intermittent flashbacks to traumatic events, and is considered substantially limited in brain function or thinking. Other examples may include conditions that may be episodic or may go into remission, which include epilepsy or cancer, hypertension, diabetes, asthma, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia. So again, just to be clear, where a certain impairment is substantially limiting of a major life activity when it is active, it is considered a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act. And I suspect there'll be some, actually I know there's some questions right on this issue, which we'll address more specifically in question time. What about temporary impairments in the ADA? There was an old rule of thumb that was a little less accurate than we'd really prefer. In retrospect, it's always nice to look back and realize the bad technical assistance that you'd given a decade ago. But the kind of rule of thumb that we used was someone expected to recover? what was their prognosis? Something that may be severely impairing, but from which someone was expecting to have was expected to have a fairly rapid recovery would not be considered a disability or covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So again, I will say I honestly, and I'm sure other people who provided technical assistance and guidance on the ADA, said a number of times to the question, is somebody who breaks their leg, who's expected to be impaired for 6 to 9 months, but is expected due to their overall physical condition, age, their response to the therapies to that point, be expected to have a complete or nearly complete recovery? And our answer was that person probably wasn't considered a person with a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There were more troubling there's more troubling litigation on this matter that deals with temporary impairments, and one that I think stands out somewhat recent was a case called Pollard versus Hayes of Baltimore, which was a Fourth Circuit case. In the Pollard case, you had an employee who worked for a small chain of retail stores. She managed, she was something of a regional manager, managing employees at up to, I think, 13 or 14 stores. She did get injured on the job, and she went on leave. She underwent some surgery. She had some complications of the surgery and returned to work under some light duty orders and orders also to work a restricted schedule. They did not, her employer did not return her to work in her position. They returned her to work in this light duty position for part-time work in a store-based rather than a regional position during her period of recovery, which again was extended. She eventually was, she fought for and was eventually had her restrictions lifted, and she sought to be returned to her original role as a higher paid employee with more regional responsibilities, and the employer did not return her to that. The court, in analyzing her case, basically decided that a 9-month recovery period, even with all the complications, were indeed a temporary disability. The court noted that there was no indication of any ongoing risks to her, even after the complications of the surgery. The court pointed to statements of Pollard, who was trying to return to work into her position and was thus positioning herself as someone able to return to work, and pressuring her doctor. The court pointed to the statements of Pollard and her doctor that she should be able to make a recovery and return to full-time duties. So basically turning her effort to push out of work restrictions into full-time and return to full-time employment as part of the evidence in support of the fact that that she was indeed only temporarily impaired. So again, as a result, the court concluded that she wasn't disabled within the meaning of the ADA. Now, moving forward, there is still some ambiguity. But let's talk about the ADA Amendments Act. The ADA Amendments Act indicates that an individual meets the requirements of being regarded as having impairment if the individual establishes that he or she has been subjected to an action prohibited in another chapter because of an actual or physical or mental impairment, whether or not the impairment limits or is perceived to limit a major life activity. The citation for this is 42 U.S.C. 12102 3B, in the regarded as having impairment. With regards to the third prong of the definition of disability, the ADA Amendments Act indicates that it shall not provide It shall not apply to impairments that are transitory or minor. A transitory impairment is an impairment with an actual or expected duration of 6 months or less. So the problem with this is that the text of the ADA Amendments Act indicates that there is an exclusion for impairments that are transitory and that are minor, but that this exclusion, I think the fair reading of it, only applies to the regarded as having an impairment, or the third prong of the definition of disability. So in its regs, the EEOC adopted and published and that have become effective, the EEOC expressly states that this transitory or minor exception does not apply to prong one and prong two. So the way that the EEOC is interpreting it, again, is that the opportunity to cover a person with a more temporary impairment, so long as that impairment is substantially impacting their ability to perform a major life activity, is available under the first prong of the definition of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So again, the EEOC expressly believes that the transitory minor exception is only limited as a defense to claims that are brought under the regarded as prong. And so they've taken this position that that protections of prong one and prong two are available for conditions that may be more temporary. More specifically, though, they state that the exclusion is only available when even under three, where the impairment is both transitory and minor. So they've even, I think, more specifically limited this under limited the limitation under prong three. And I've kind of mashed this up, but so let me kind of back up on this. While the specific text of the ADA Amendments Act mentions temporary impairments, or at least arguably does, in a part of the text that that limits the application of the protections of being regarded as having a disability where those impairments are transitory and minor, the EEOC is interpreting that to only exclude protection where the claim is under the prong three regarded as and the impairment is both transitory and minor. So I think that there's some ambiguity, and I think that the issue is going to be unclear until this is judicially tested. But what is clear is that the EEOC will likely move towards testing such issues in the courts and entertain more temporary, or what we used to claim were temporary impairments and not covered under the ADA. Moving forward, I believe the EEOC will take that on. So if I didn't make too much of a hash of that, we'll move on. Pregnancy is a disability. In its historical guidance on the ADA, the EEOC, maintained that pregnancy was not an impairment and it wasn't covered under the ADA as a disability under the ADA. And more recently, the EEOC indicates that pregnancy may give rise to substantial impairments that are disabilities covered under the ADA. And you may ask yourself, as we did in the webcast on pregnancy and pregnancy disability in the ADA back in spring of 2012, why the radical change? Well, the EEOC argues that this is not really a radical change, but really a clarification of their position that pregnancy without complications is not a physical or mental impairment that arises to an ADA disability, but that where the medical complications that may surround pregnancy and that may create physical and mental impairments that actually do limit a major life activity or activities are disabilities and that these may entitle an employee to workplace accommodations. The EEOC guidance specifically references preeclampsia and gestational diabetes as specific potential complicating factors of pregnancy that may be considered a disability. So let me be clear, the EEOC is not stating that all women who are pregnant are people with disabilities, but where certain circumstances under some pregnancies create an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity, then it may give rise to the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act as a disability. The EEOC also maintains that pregnancy-related impairments may also meet the definition of disability, as it acts as a record of substantially limited impairment, where it may do so, or it creates a circumstance where an employee is regarded as being disabled and is subsequently discriminated against by an employer, for example. So to this end, the EEOC has gone further. In this past year, in its SEP, or its Strategic Enforcement Plan, the EEOC indicated that it intended to move forward with more globally with more pregnancy discrimination litigation, and it has, but also specifically more into this emerging opportunity under the ADA Amendments Act to litigate under that umbrella with regards to pregnancy. And you can imagine circumstances where that might arise. So, for example, a woman who works for an employer that is large enough to be covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but it's a small enough workplace to not be covered under the Family Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, and ask for leave related to complications of the pregnancy as an ADA accommodation. Again, this is a specific scenario where the EEOC seems empathetic and appears to be moving into some litigation. I think also of note is that just this past spring, the EEOC secured a settlement in a case that we mentioned in our webcast on pregnancy and disability in the ADA. The EEOC secured a settlement in the case EEOC versus Engineering Documentation Systems, where they secured a $70,000 settlement along with some typical sensitivity trainings and policy changes. The facts of that case were I at least as represented by the plaintiff side, pretty good case. Upon learning of the pregnancy, a manager was alleged to have made derogatory remarks to the employee who was pregnant. Additionally, was alleged to deny a request to move her office closer to a restroom to accommodate her early symptom nausea and vomiting. Later, while she was out on leave, the employer changed her job description, suddenly requiring that she be certified to carry live ammunition and explosives. And this, again, is alleged by the EEOC in their petition. In addition, the EEOC alleges that the employer failed to engage in an interactive process or to accommodate the employee and terminated her while she was on a leave of absence. In addition, the EEOC also further asserts that the husband, who was also employed by the same employer, was retaliated against in as much as he was demoted and eventually fired after complaining of his wife's treatment and participating in the lawful EEO activity of his wife, presumably offering some evidence to the EEOC while investigating his wife's claim. So again, a pretty good case from a plaintiff's lawyer perspective and a pretty solid outcome for the EEOC, and I think it indicates their willingness to move forward into this arena and now their success. What about phobias in the ADA? Well, let's just kind of lay this out there and define phobias. According to the American Psychiatric Association, a phobia isn't just a basic fear. It's an irrational and an excessive fear of an object or situation. And in most cases, the phobia involves a sense of endangerment or a fear of harm. So for example, somebody who's somebody who has a agoraphobia may have a fear of being trapped in an inescapable place or an inescapable situation. Phobias may manifest a variety of symptoms. Because somebody's exposed to a particular object or a certain situation, but the symptoms may manifest in absence of direct stimulus, because merely the person is thinking about the situation that they fear or the object that they fear. Symptoms, again, associated with phobias include dizziness, difficulty breathing, nausea, a broken sense of self or unreality, an irrational fear of death, etc. And in some cases, you know, phobias can escalate into a full-scale anxiety attack. As a consequence of this, of these symptoms, additional impairments may arise, and people may limit their social exposure, may limit their access to education. It may have an impact beyond that kind of direct physical symptomology and really impact them in broad, arenas of daily life. So it seems abundantly clear that a phobia would be covered as a disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act, so long as it was suitably and substantially impairing. So above a more basic fear, a reasonable and rational, fear of walking into a spider web versus a more socially crippling form level of fear that a diagnosed clinical diagnosis of a phobia might be. When I worked as a technical assistant staff for the ADA centers, and since then, I think the situations where I got asked about phobias were, fairly rare situations, and they tended to be basically the conflict situation, the issue of dueling disabilities, where you had somebody who, for example, used a guide dog for the blind to help them navigate, working in the same office as somebody who had a fear of dogs. And the question is, does the fear of dogs arise to a level of a disability on the ADA? And the answer was maybe, if again it's substantially impairing someone in major life activities rather than merely being somewhat afraid of a dog. A somewhat recent situation, actually, I think that's happened in a number of jurisdictions, where a cab driver denied access to a would-be passenger who used a guide dog. There is a case right now, I believe, in New York, where a cab driver is asserting that their dislike or fear of dogs is in fact a phobia, and it may very well be. I think the reality of this case is where this cab driver was dismissed. My guess is they're going to have a hard time asserting that they were a qualified individual with a disability, in as much as I think it's reasonable to assume that people who are blind, who use guide dogs, cannot be denied rides under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So I think it may very well prove to be an essential function of any open or dispatch cab driver that they be willing to pick up a person with who's using a guide dog in front of their maybe legitimate phobia that arises to a level of an ADA disability. they still may not be a qualified person with a disability. What about alcohol in the ADA? Let's just be clear. In all 50 states in this country, it's legal to drink. There's no legal prohibition against being an alcoholic unless you're under some restrictions of court. However, in the ADA specifically allows coverage of somebody who's an alcoholic, prohibits discrimination on the basis of their alcoholism, but at the same time, nothing in the Act or the regulations disallow an employer to place reasonable performance expectations and to require that employees be free from the impact of alcohol in their workplace. There may be questions on that, and we'll certainly entertain them, but I think that's pretty much the clear outline situation. It gets a little more complicated with regards to drugs in the ADA. Current illegal drug users are explicitly not covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, but the question that we get is, what does current mean in this context? There's a case on point that's somewhat recent out of the 10th Circuit. It's Maurer Hahn versus Wagner Corporation. In this case, a salesman worked for a packaging company, and he tested positive for cocaine and marijuana, and he was fired. The company then advised him very generously that if he could successfully rehabilitate, that he could be rehired. The salesman did go to an inpatient rehab program, a 30-day program, and on the completion of his program, a counselor said that he had a quote, guarded chance of staying clean. The salesman did a reapply, and the company said that he could come back, but the company indicated that he couldn't come back at the same rate of pay, the same level of responsibilities, or calling on the same field of customers. They were going to rein him in somewhat, but allow him to return. The former employee sued, alleged that the potential reduction in pay and that the changing in the scope of his access to clients was unfair. He said that he wasn't a current drug user under the ADA when the company refused to restore him to his old job, so he was being discriminated against on the basis of a history of drug use. He lost on appeals. The court threw out the court disagreed with the salesman and took an opportunity, I think, to offer what they believe is somewhat helpful guidance on this. I'm not entirely sure that it's going to help provide advocates, people with disabilities, people recovering who are wanting to assert protections, or for employees writing policies, the best bright line law. The court in this case. The court refused to give a specific number of weeks or months that someone who is recovering from drug use must be clean before they're not considered current user. The court indicated that the point is an absolute amount of time, and somewhat, somewhat vaguely, but certainly indicated that although certainly the longer an individual refrains from drug use, the more likely he or she will qualify for ADA protections. And the court basically indicated that instead of a bright line black letter limit of 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years clean, the court said that the test of whether someone is a current user, that they, again, this test that they created whole cloth, was whether or not the person had used drugs recently enough to give the employer a reasonable belief that the drug use is an ongoing problem or not. So I don't really have an answer on how long you have to be clean. And I don't really think this decision really offers enough clarity for you to start making policy on it or to bank on it as protection for yourself if you're somebody who's recovering from drug use. It's unclear what amount of rehabilitation and clean time would be considered necessary for someone to be considered a non-current user. Certainly, Certainly within the Fourth Circuit, you know you at least have this ambiguous goal to seek. You need to be convincing and successful, and you need to give your employer a I guess enough certitude that you are in successful recovery. So again, I think it remains a basic fact question. It was here and remains a fact question. And so if you're litigating this one way or the other, on one side or the other, get some experts. And I'm sorry I can't be more clear on that. Okay, what about marijuana? Let me be clear to disclose this. I now live in the state of Washington, where not only marijuana for medical purposes, but now recreational use marijuana is at least decriminalized. In the honest and fair disclosure, though, I will tell you that I'm not under the influence of medical or recreational marijuana at this time, or nor do I intend to be. But since I'm in the state of Washington, I'm going to talk a little bit about some marijuana cases here. In the case Jane Roe versus Teletech Customer Care Management, the state of Washington Supreme Court ruled that an employer could fire a worker who uses medical marijuana even when the worker uses the drug at home and experiences no side effects on the job. In the decision from June of last year, or actually June of 2011, this state's high court found that the state's marijuana law, which protects patients from criminal prosecutions, allows no recourse in employment disputes. The Medical Use of Marijuana Act, as it's called, does not provide an unlimited right. And although there was a pretty strong dissent, again, the verdict of the court was that they weren't protected. The facts of the case are simple. There's a woman who worked in the north of Seattle in a customer service firm. It fired her when she failed a drug test. The woman told the company that she used marijuana as prescribed by her doctor for debilitating migraines. The company had required the drug test for her employment. And she was hired in 2006, but she failed the test and she was fired a week later. So she sued. The court again held that the Medical Use of Marijuana Act did not provide a private cause of action for discharge of an employee who uses medical marijuana either expressly or impliedly, nor does it create a public policy that would support a claim for wrongful discharge for such a policy. So even in this state, even where it's clearly a not prosecutable offense under state law, the Supreme Court of the state has indicated that you're not protected. I think there's around 20 states now and in D.C. that have laws that allow some level of medical marijuana use to treat, certain medical conditions. Some of them are more restricted than the other. Several of these states have no protections for workplace discriminations, no specific protections for workplace discrimination, including the state of Washington, either because of the way those laws are written or because of litigation. However, several states have either an implicit protection where the law only mentions on-the-job consumption or impairments. These include Colorado, Hawaii, Michigan, New Mexico, and a couple of others. That imply that workers can't be fired for use that occurs outside the workplace. However, there are some state laws that have explicit protections: Arizona, Delaware, Maine, and Rhode Island. Even where there is some level of assumed or presumed protection under state laws, legalizing marijuana for medical purposes, we're seeing a line of litigation that suggests that perhaps you're not protected in employment. Again, Colorado, which has medical marijuana, and like the state that I now live in, has recently made recreational use of marijuana legal and will begin retail sales in January. I'm not encouraging anybody to do any pot tourism, but there, that is a reality. In the case Coats versus Dish Network from just spring of this year, dealt with this issue. Coloradans who use medical marijuana off the clock now appears to be at risk of being fired. There was a Colorado Court of Appeals decision. Now, this is not the terminal court. This is an intermediary appellate court. Upheld a firing of Brandon Coates for an off-the-job medical marijuana use, holding that because marijuana is illegal under federal law, employees have no protection to use it at any time. This case was the first to look at whether any off-duty marijuana use in the state of Colorado is legal under the state law. Colorado has a law called the Lawful Off-Duty Activity Statute, and this statute essentially says that employers cannot fire an employee for doing things that are legal when they're off the clock. The background of the case is basically this: Dish Network fired Brandon Coates. He was a telephone operator, a tech. He was somebody who's undoubtedly a person with a disability. He uses a wheelchair for his mobility because of spinal injuries caused by a car wreck. He used marijuana and was prescribed it to control muscle spasm after not responding to other medications or having more severe side effects than the medical marijuana produced. He was fired for failing drug tests. He sued Dish, arguing that the marijuana use was legal under state law there, and that he was never impaired on the job, which was never an issue. Never claimed by the defendant. In addition, Coates asserted that he was at least a claimed model employee, but at least an employee with decent work history. The trial court upheld the firing, and the Colorado Court of Appeals backed up the trial court, basically stating that nothing that is illegal from a federal perspective can be considered lawful even under a state law, and even given the specifics of Colorado's lawful off-duty activity statute. Now, I suspect that this case will be appealed to the Colorado Supreme Court. And again, while I'm enormously empathetic to individuals who need the this is a personal disclosure, who need medical marijuana. I believe it has medical efficacy. The American Medical Association more generally agrees, but I don't think we're at the tipping point where we are going to see anytime soon this move from a national level. I think we are going to see more and more states add protections for medical marijuana and then extend that into recreational marijuana. To be honest, it's really only a matter of time, but it is a matter of time. So this is my opinion, is that I don't think you're going to see much success asserting your right as a person with a disability to the benefits of medical marijuana in the workplace if your workplace chooses to maintain a drug-free workplace standard and initiate drug testing. As a policy matter, in those states that have chosen to acknowledge this, of course, employers are free to extend those protections to employees and not just take the step because they can. I encourage, again, people to realize that again, a personal perspective, that there's some, efficacy and legitimacy in this. But that's my personal opinion. Okay, what about domestic violence, stalking, and sexual assault under the Americans with Disabilities Act? This one's really interesting. The EEOC very recently released guidance titled, and that we provided a link to, Questions and Answers, the Application of Title VII and the ADA to Applicants or Employees Who Experience Domestic or Dating Violence, Sexual Assault, or Stalking. Again, I encourage you to see those materials for a more lengthy discussion. But in this publication, the EEOC asks and answers a question about a potential application of the ADA to employment decisions that might violate the ADA. And involve applicants or employees who experience this type of violence, assault, or stalking. So the question is what are some examples of employment decisions that may violate the ADA that involve these situations? And the answer in their guidance is that the ADA provides prohibits different treatment or harassment at work based on actual or perceived impairment, which could include impairments resulting from domestic or dating violence, sexual assault, or stalking, for example, where an employer searches the applicant's name online and learns that she was the complaining witness in a rape prosecution, and received counseling for depression, where the employer decides not to hire her based on a concern that she may require future time off, for continuing symptoms might be actionable. In addition, where an employee has facial scarring from skin grafts, which were necessary after she was badly burned in an attack by a former domestic partner, when she returns to work after a lengthy hospitalization, coworkers subject her to frequent abusive comments about her skin grafts, and her manager fails to take any action to stop the harassment. The EEOC indicates that the ADA may require employers to provide reasonable accommodations requested for an actual disability or a record of involving these circumstances, an actual disability. Again, reiterating that an actual disability may, is a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities or a record of or being regarded as. So again, it appears that the EEOC is kind of, again, opening itself into an arena maybe a logical application or an extension of the ADA in these kind of narrow circumstances. So are there any questions at this time? We've got a little bit of time left. Marissa?
Aaron, we have Marissa? a bunch of questions. Can
well,
you
good. I didn't think it would take that long to get through the material. So let's get them.
We do. I'm going to start with one because it's more pertinent to the last thing that you addressed with regards to domestic violence and stalking. This one came in. It says, if an employer discovers during the background check that someone was subjected to, for example, a sexual assault, are we allowed to ask questions with regards to this in the process of pre-employment screening?
Are you allowed to ask questions? I would say it would be unwise to ask questions. I think, again, the EEOC guidance would tend to suggest that this is something that they would consider a no-no. It would tend to elicit information that would be suggestive of disability, because it might, one, it's intrusive, it seems hardly work-related, but it might reveal a level of trauma and treatment for trauma with some underlying diagnosis that, again, may be argued to be a disability on the ADA. So it seems like a bad idea. Next question.
Okay. And then along those same lines, let's see here. Oh, here we go. We have an employee who occasionally takes time off due to adjustments she needs to make for an ex-husband she has a restraining order against. Is this something that would qualify for FMLA-related leave?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what she's taking the adjustments for. If it's to seek counseling, I think you can certainly make an argument that she could, make a claim for leave and potentially FMLA leave. If it's to handle some financial issues or just to move some of her equipment, some of her personal items, then it doesn't seem that FMLA would be applicable to that circumstance. Although it'd be a pretty cold employee where that wouldn't be unduly burdensome, wouldn't allow for those kinds of adjustments, unpaid leave. Next question.
Okay.
So don't be mean.
All right. This is along the lines of, it sounds like a school. We have a student that we're trying to accommodate at our college who is obese. Is obesity considered a disability?
That's one of those interesting questions, and I get it, because the press has reported on both sides of this issue. Either obesity is or obesity isn't a disability, according to journalists who are looking at the same set of decisions or actions of regulatory agencies. I think in and of itself, obesity is not a disability. While there are consequences long-term of being obese, it is possible that someone who is obese by whatever definition, a percentage of body fat over an ideal, someone who's young, who hasn't had the joint damage associated with it, et cetera, who might not meet at least the prong one definition of disability. Of where they had an actual physical or mental impairment. However, and again, in full disclosure, I'm not a slender reed. I undoubtedly will meet the requirements for obesity. It has long-term effects. I think the global impact of obesity, particularly over time, would probably add up to someone who was disabled. I mean, if somebody had, the consequences of obesity are joint damage, potential heart disease, diabetes, and the complications that flow from all those things. So under certain circumstances, undoubtedly, the impact of obesity would arise to make someone a person with a disability on the ADA. In and of itself, no. Under these circumstances, I don't know. In a school setting, we would need some facts to understand exactly what, the actual situation was, and what they were trying to accommodate. So I can't really answer that question, but perhaps we can get some more specifics. Next question.
Sure. This is switching gears a little bit here. This question is gender dysphoria a disability under the ADAA?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what gender dysphoria is. I vaguely remember it from some clinical classes that I have. I'm not sure. Again, I think you have to look at the basic diagnosis. Is it a physical or a mental impairment that substantially interferes with someone's ability to perform a major life activity? And doesn't meet one of the specific exceptions. I don't think gender identity disorders, and I'm not exactly sure whether gender dysphoria is a newer DSM, whatever it is now, 5, version of GID. It may or may not be, and I don't want to insult somebody for asking. But that was a specific exclusion under the under the ADA in 1991. It still is. So, I'd have to have some more facts. I don't know. Next question. Please,
okay,
next
question. This is more of a request. They were wanting you to discuss, PTSD, depression, school phobia-related absences. For example, when a student has a physician letter and it's been problematic with 504 plans in the VOTEC schools, but also in K-12.
Well, again, presumably we're talking, under most circumstances, we'd be talking about a Title II issue. And my guess is this: if someone has a documented disability, they have an ADA or a 504 plan, and it's failing to meet the needs of that student so that they can be accommodated and move forward in their educational path, then one, that 504 plan needs to be adjusted. But it doesn't need to be adjusted to the point where it creates a fundamental alteration in the program. So in a VOTEC setting or tech school setting, that makes a little more sense. If somebody's going through a pretty complex, let's say, multi-metals welding program, and their disability and fear interferes with their ability to actually attend to the instructions and engage in the practicals and the labs for that, then perhaps they need to be accommodated, but they don't need to be accommodated so much that they fundamentally alter the nature of the program to render it useless. So, again, without some more facts, I really couldn't offer you an answer except to say if they have a pretty well documented set of diagnoses and it has some impact, then they probably are a person with a disability, and perhaps you need to revisit this or whoever this is, a way to accommodate this person. But at some point they may not be no longer eligible for that program. Next question.
Okay, I think we have time for one more.
Good.
This goes back to the pregnancy as a disability, and they're asking, is infertility thus? Would infertility be protected under the ADAAA in terms of needing to take leave from your employer to get treatment for infertility? Would that qualify?
That's an interesting application. I think there's a strong argument that it would qualify under FMLA, assuming that someone worked for an employer large enough to be a covered employer under the FMLA. And I think you can make that argument. If in fact it's in a, and I'm assuming we're, if we're talking about an employer, that's an, I can't say, but it would be an interesting test. I'm unaware of where that's been litigated, but I know I'm very nerdily in the next 10 or 20 minutes going to be looking and seeing whether that's been litigated. I think it's a very interesting issue, and it seems like it might very well fit. But you know, I can't say yes or no. I would entertain another question, but it looks like we're up against our own self-imposed wall. So. If you've got time, I've got time.
We are just about out of time.
Well,
we are out of time, but what we could do, Aaron, if you're okay with this, is if there's any questions still lingering that we did not get to today, and I know there are a couple, you could email us at swdbtac@ilru.org, and we'll share them with Aaron, and he can provide the answer, and what we'll do is we will post the answer to those with the archive file later on, if that's okay, Aaron.
That is okay with me, and again, I ran a little over long, so it would be rude of me not to to do so. And again, these are some really great questions, some of which I've been unable to answer, but I'll make every effort to if you ask them. So please do if you have a burning question, and thank you all for your time.
Okay. Well, thank you, Aaron. Again, this concludes today's webinar program. Like I said earlier, we realize some of you may have had questions that we didn't get to, so we apologize. We will share those with Aaron, and we can post them later on if you want to email them too. I just posted the email address there. It's swdbtac@ilru.org. Again, we want to thank Aaron for joining us and sharing his time and extensive knowledge with us today. We certainly learned a lot. A reminder that today's session was recorded and it will be available for viewing in the archive section within about 24 hours at www.ada-audio.org. We do invite you to join us for the next scheduled session on January 15th. That's the top ADA cases of 2013, featuring Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg, I hope I said that correctly, with Equip for Equality. Questions, again, regarding this or other sessions in the series can be directed to 877-232-1990 or via email to ADA Conferences@adagreatlakes.org. You will receive a link to the evaluation via email at the conclusion of our program today, as well as instructions regarding securing certificates of attendance or continuing education recognition. We encourage you to participate and share your views with us, as they're always valued. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us today. Thanks so much, Aaron, and thank you to the awesome people at the Great Lakes staff for running it for us. Again, thank you all, and you may now disconnect your browser.